It's philosophy talk.
Two stars?
Wasn't a meaningful encounter.
Does reputation matter?
Yeah, reputation's a useful social screening mechanism.
Yeah, but it's so often based on nothing more than gossip.
That's the sense you get just from me?
From your rep report analytics. If we drill down into the numbers, you have got a solid popularity arc here. Strong overall trajectory.
Should you care about what people think about you?
You've got a ton of reciprocal 5 stars from service industry workers, but there's not much else. You could use a punch-up right there. Ideally, that's upvotes from quality people.
Is reputation all it's cracked up to be?
Our guest is Gloria Arigi, author of Reputation, What It Is and Why It Matters.
Oh, I'm a 4.2.
I'm afraid you're actually a 4.183.
Does reputation matter?
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
As Thanksgiving approaches, we want you to know that we're grateful to you, our listeners.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk.
How much should you care about your reputation?
Can caring too much turn you into a faker?
Can caring too little make you smug?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Josh Landy. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus where I teach philosophy and Josh directs the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today we're asking, does reputation matter?
On that one, Josh, I'm with the Stoics. We don't have any control over reputation, they say, so we shouldn't waste any time thinking about it at all. Just be a good person. Do good work. Forget the critics. Haters gonna hate, you know.
I just don't think it's that simple. I mean, it's not like our reputation is completely out of our control. If I go around, you know, kicking puppies in front of everybody, I'm going to get a reputation as a puppy kicker, and that's going to be my own fault.
Well, Josh, if you kick puppies, you should kick them behind closed doors.
Oh, no, that's not what I meant. Don't kick puppies at all.
Oh, well, look, okay. But people could still say that you are a puppy kicker. I mean, they could mistake you for somebody else, or they could even deliberately lie about you. Josh, I hate to tell you this, but you know, there's a lot of malicious gossip out there about you.
Oh, well, thanks at least for not telling me about it. Okay, so fair enough. Maybe we don't have complete control over reputation. I'll grant you that. But surely you can make it more likely that your reputation's a decent one. And it matters to do that because, you know, if you have a bad reputation, you can get ostracized.
Well, Josh, okay, I see your point. But I still say that if you get too hung up on your reputation, you're going to end up a totally inauthentic, self-promoting social climber or something. I mean, you're going to go to dumb places just so you can post a photo on Facebook. You're going to go to concerts by famous bands you can't stand. You're going to pretend to like obscure philosophy just so you seem cool or something.
Yeah, okay. But I don't know. Those seem like superficial foibles. I mean, are you claiming that, you know, concern for reputation is going to reach all the way down and warp my character?
That's exactly what I'm claiming. Too much concern for your reputation is a recipe for a deeply self-alienated life, Josh.
Well, maybe if all you think about is your reputation, that might be true. But that's not what I'm suggesting. I mean, I'm just saying reputation should be one of the things you care about. And if it is one of the things you care about, it can actually make you a more authentic person.
Oh, Josh, you're dreaming.
No, I'm not. I mean, Ken, you use things like Yelp, don't you, and TripAdvisor?
Well, yeah, but so what?
Well, so clearly you do care about reputation. You care about the reputation of a restaurant or a hotel or a movie.
Yeah, but what's that got to do? That's got nothing to do with me and my reputation.
What's so special about you? If you trust reputation when it comes to other people and their businesses, you should also trust it when it comes to yourself.
No, Josh, because I already know who and what I am. I don't need no Yelp reviews to tell me about myself.
Maybe you should read those reviews. At least they're honest.
Oh, Josh, that's cold.
No, but seriously, Ken, look, human beings don't always know themselves very well. So, you know, we need to check in with other people to make sure we're not just telling ourselves a bunch of self-serving stories. I mean, you can't say you're funny, for example, if nobody ever laughs at your jokes.
Yeah, okay, that's true. But I still say you got to think about the big picture. I mean, the cost of this massive reputation system we develop far outweighs the benefits. It's destroying people's lives. You make one small step, misstep, you know, kick one little puppy. And suddenly, everyone on the internet is lining up to drag you completely through the mud and ruin your life.
Yeah, look, okay, true. That's true. But by the same token, the possibility of shame is motivating. It motivates us to be better people. Right? And meanwhile, the reputation system gives us early warning about bad guys who might come in and mess up our lives. So, I mean, thanks to the reputation system, I don't have to listen to unfunny comedians, eat at bad restaurants, or read bad philosophy. Hooray for reputation.
Yeah, some people are more shameless than you realize, Josh. But look, there's a lot to argue about here, a lot to discuss. Maybe our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, can help a bit. We sent her to investigate reputation management strategies of two well-known musical acts. She files this report.
Taylor Swift has gone through so many different reputations over the years, but she still remains one of the best-selling artists in the world. If you want a quick tour through those reputations, start with her single, Look What You Made Me Do.
I don't like your little games, don't like your tilted stage.
The music video is weird. It begins with Swift as a zombie, bursting out of a grave. She declares, the old Taylor cannot answer the phone right now.
Why? She's dead.
Then all of her reputations over the years line up in a row. There's Taylor Swift, the country singer, Taylor Swift, the snake, Taylor Swift, the victim, Taylor Swift holding a VMA award. That one is a reference to the time in 2009 when Kanye West went on stage and declared Beyonce should have won.
Yo, Taylor, I'm really happy for you. I'm gonna let you finish, but Beyonce had one of the best videos of all time.
Look what you just made me do.
On her recent album, appropriately titled Reputation, Swift sings a lot about her own public persona and feuding with Kanye West. But she has a reputation for staying out of politics that may have lost her a few diehard fans. BuzzFeed reporter Alana Bennett says she's a fan of Swift's music, but not her public image.
Regardless of the intent, her silence did speak volumes for a really long time.
A lot of fans were angry when, in 2017, Swift sued a blogger who demanded she denounce her white supremacist fan base.
She was still being silent while she was also punishing the people who were taking note of how her persona played into the white supremacy that was rising all around the country.
Bennett has her theories about why Swift is usually silent about politics. Maybe she doesn't want her reputation to end up like, say, the Dixie Chicks.
Past 18, he was waiting for the bus in his army.
The Dixie Chicks have become a cautionary tale. Be careful what you say, or this could happen to you.
Beverly Keel, chair of the Department of Recording Industry at Middle Tennessee State University, says this cautionary tale begins in 2003. It's 2 years after 9/11, days before U.S. troops will invade Iraq, and the Dixie Chicks are the darlings of country music. So they went down.
The Dixie Chicks were that rare blend of critical darling and commercial darling. Everybody loved them.
And then they hated them. During a concert in London, lead singer Natalie Maines said she was ashamed President George W. Bush was from Texas. The fallout is shown in the documentary Shut Up and Sing.
I think we in South Carolina ought to say goodbye to the Dixie Chicks, and anybody that thinks about going to that concert ought to be ready to run away from
them. God bless GW!
I think they are the ditzy twits. These are the dumbest bimbos, with due respect, I have seen.
These are callow, foolish women who deserve to be slapped around.
Country music radio stations banned their songs. Ex-fans met in parking lots to crush Dixie Chick CDs with tractors. President Bush weighed in.
I mean, the Dixie Chicks are free to speak their mind. They can say what they want to say. And just because, I mean, they shouldn't have their feelings hurt just because some people don't want to buy their records.
At the time, Bush had a reputation for standing up for freedom, and Iraq had a reputation for weapons of mass destruction. Keel says the whole country and country music was swept up in a patriotic fervor. Take Toby Keith, for example. Country music shunned the Dixie Chicks, so they turned their backs on country music.
You know, their career has not been the same, but the thought was, well, if country radio is not going to play us, then we'll just release whatever we want anyway.
So the band released Not Ready to Make Nice, a song about how their reputations as traitors led to fans mailing them death threats. Many country radio stations still refuse to play them, but their next album won them 5 Grammy Awards. Taylor Swift rarely speaks to the public, so her reputation is based on her catchy pop songs and general silence. But the Dixie Chicks turned their reputation as un-American anti-war villains into a country album. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Did the Dixie Chicks care too little, or does Taylor Swift care too much about reputation? I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy. And today we're asking, does reputation matter?
We're joined now by Gloria Arigi, senior researcher at the Institut Jean Nicot in Paris, and author of Reputation, What It Is and Why It Matters. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Gloria.
Hi, thank you.
So, Gloria, not a lot of philosophers have written about reputation. I wonder what first got you interested in this subject. Were you thinking about, like, celebrity culture and politics, or worse yet, maybe the reputation of some of our fellow academics?
No, not really. Actually, I live in Paris. I'm Italian, and I come from Milano, which is a sort of town of fashion, etc. So probably, and I think I come from a culture and a milieu which is particularly obsessed by reputation, image, social judgment, etc. So probably it was much easier for me to see the relevance of reputation in philosophy, which you're right. I mean, it's not such a glamorous topic in philosophy. At least it was not when I started. Now it seems to be everywhere. Even
yeah, you've changed. You're a trendsetter.
Yeah, actually,
right.
Actually, the book was out in the United States the same month in which the Taylor Swift album Reputation was out. But actually, unfortunately, I didn't have the same. I mean, the fortune of the two products is quite different.
That makes perfect sense about how you got into it. I'm curious now what you end up concluding. I mean, it's, why do people get so obsessed about their reputations?
Well, because they should. Reputation is everywhere. We can't help having a reputation. I mean, reputation is the social trace that we leave around us each time we act. Now I'm speaking. Now, here, I'm in Paris. You're in California, and I leave a trace of myself. I mean, my voice and my accent, for example. And so it's a trace that we produce anyway. I mean, all our actions. And so we have to be... care about it.
But don't you think, Gloria, okay, I get you that we have to care about it to some extent. Let's grant that. But don't you think it's possible to care too much? And I suppose it's possible to care too little, too. Don't you agree that it's hard to figure out how much to care? Or do you not agree?
I think we care too much. Maybe we think sometimes we care too much because we feel vulnerable about reputation. We don't know exactly what it is. We don't know exactly how it changes, why it transforms, why one day we are cool and the day after we are just like forgotten by everybody. So we don't know the rules about it. So it's something that is very intimate. It's related to all the production of an image of ourselves that we do in our everyday life. Are we leaving traces of ourselves around, etc.? And on the other, so it's something that is very intimate. It's related to our very intimate concern. And on the other hand, we have the feeling we don't have the control. We don't control it. So this is why we become obsessed.
So, I mean, you talk about, you know, we lose our reputation or gain our reputation. I mean, for most of us who live ordinary lives, for celebrities and famous people, they have all this machinery dedicated to stoking and creating and managing their reputation. I mean, if you're the Dixie Chicks, it matters a lot. But what about a schmuck like me, just an unknown schmuck like me going about my business every day? Should I care the way that, say, celebrities or politicians who are, like, all about reputation management, should I care the way they care?
You shouldn't care in the same way. I mean, each one should have a personal strategy that fits a project, a need. So you can also, you may decide to have a bad reputation. You may decide to find strategies in order not to accumulate a reputation. For example, I'm basically nobody. I'm very happy that you invited me because, I mean,
not anymore, Gloria, not anymore.
And now, after I know, after philosophy talks, and I'm sure that Taylor Swift is listening to us. So, Taylor, hi, I'm here. And I wrote the book about reputation. It was so, and so I'm sure that I'm becoming, I will become a star tomorrow. But I mean, for the moment, I'm nobody. I come from Italy, almost third world, and I moved to France. I have a terrible accent. So, of course, I mean, I struggle also to construct a reputation, but my strategies are very different from the one of a star, of a celebrity. So each one has to have a strategy about his or her own reputation, but which is in line with an objective.
So Gloria, this is fascinating stuff, and I'm really eager to dig into it with you more. But we have to take a break now. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about reputation with Gloria Origi, author of Reputation: What It Is and Why It Matters.
Is it rational to care so much about your reputation? Shouldn't some people care more about it instead of just doing whatever they feel like? And are reputations reliable in the first place?
Reputation, rationality, and reliability, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
If you enjoy our program, there are lots of ways you can support what we do.
Subscribe to our enormous archive of past episodes.
Buy subscriptions for the thinkers in your life.
Purchase someone a mug, tote, or tea at our new online shop.
Or make a tax-deductible donation by going to philosophytalk.org.
Please do your part to help keep us on the air and online.
Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
And now, back to the show.
Would a bad reputation matter any more or less than a good one? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and today we're thinking about reputation. Our guest is Gloria Origi, author of Reputation, What It Is, and Why It Matters.
So, Gloria, I think I can guess here whose side you're on, Josh and me. I think I can guess. Mm-hmm. I was arguing that excessive concern for your reputation is a recipe for inauthenticity. He was arguing that it motivates us to be better people. So where do you stand on this? As if I can't guess, but help me.
Okay, first of all, I'm not a moral philosopher. I know that at a certain point of their life, all philosophers try to become a moral philosopher. I'm not. I'm not here to tell you. I'm not. I don't know if I'm an immoral philosopher. Clearly, I'm an amoral philosopher. So I'm an epistemologist. I'm interested in understanding things. I'm not here to tell you what is good and what is bad. I mean, if you want to be obsessed for your reputation, can do. And B, and if Josh doesn't care about, it's okay. I mean, or the opposite, I don't remember. So I'm not here to tell you if it is good or bad. What I'm here to tell you is that it is impossible to get rid of a reputation. You're producing a reputation with every gesture, just breathing. I mean, so you have something. It's a sort of cloud that accompanies you, an avatar of yourself that is the social trace that is outside in the social world, and it depends on you, and depends on what you do, and this is something that is there. I mean, and of course, I mean, depends. Of course, what is the circle that is? It matters for you. It can be your colleagues. It can be the general audience. It can be your family. But you can't help in producing a reputation, and so you must be a little bit strategic about what you do with your social ego.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah. But I there was something really brilliant that you said in your book that actually, I mean, you're being wonderfully modest about your moral philosophy side. But I thought you made
plus you're being modest about your fame too,
right? but I thought you made this.
I bet on you guys.
But so let me sort of run by you your own, one of your own arguments, which I think was really fascinating, about how reputation can actually make us more moral. I took you to be saying that there's a kind of outside-in improvement that we can do, where we start off pretending to be virtuous just to cultivate a reputation. Then other people see us be apparently being virtuous, and now they start to expect us to become more virtuous. And lo and behold, it turns into a kind of benevolent circle. And so maybe it is morally improving.
So that's what Josh was arguing, and he seems to have borrowed that from you. Do you endorse that argument?
I think the back and forth between our sort of more intimate ego and this social ego is a very complex dynamic. So we start to pretend to be someone, to have a certain image, and then we become what we are. But I mean, you're making the moral case in which we start to pretend to have a certain, I don't know, good reputation for a certain moral behavior, and then
right.
So this is something that is an adjustment. I give some you're right. I mean, I give some examples of this sort of lucky moral development that can happen by pretending to be someone, for example, better than what you are, etc. And so then people create expectations, and so you don't want to. But I mean,
but Gloria,
yeah.
On the other side of that, there's the Glaucon and Anaximandros in Plato's Republic. He's one of the early philosophers to talk about reputation. And they say, well, Plato, Socrates, you're arguing for justice and all that. But here's the best thing. The best thing is to be an unjust person, to be thought just. Because then you get the benefit of the reputation for justice. I mean, everybody wants to be around you. They invite you to all the parties. But if you're secretly unjust because you have this, like, magical ring that hides your acts, if you're secretly unjust, you get to sleep with the king's wife and steal and have debauchery. So wouldn't the best thing to be have a great reputation but be free because you can do it in secret to do all the lousy, immoral, self-aggrandizing acts that you want? Wouldn't that be the best life?
Well, it's very difficult to do it. I mean, the best reputation is a signal, and I mean, the best way of signaling something is to be to have the property that you're signaling. So,
yeah.
If you want really to have, I mean, just to signal that I'm Italian, the best thing is to have an Italian accent.
Right.
It's very difficult to fake. So, robust reputation is it works when it is based on robust signals. Of course, I mean, many people, I mean, we all do things that, I mean, we pretend to be better, nicer, younger, whatever. And so we can adjust. There is a sort of a mismatch between what we really are and what is our social image and what is reputation. But, I mean, it is very difficult to entertain a reputation which is based on nothing.
Actually,
you can do it. There are stories that are based on this. You can do it if you already have some other kinds of authority, for example.
Yeah, I got
Gloria. Gloria,
I get that it's a difficult thing to pull off. I get that, and so most people couldn't pull it off. And I get you talk about reputation as a signaling system, and I get that. That's really important stuff. That's a fascinating part of your book. But here's the thing: I was thinking about that. You sometimes use some evolutionary stuff. You diss the misuse of it, I guess. But here's the thing: I was thinking about that. You know, we were evolved to signal to our compatriots what we're like and all that. And those signals, the more reliable and they are, the more opportunities for cooperation and all that we had. But, you know, I was trying to figure out, I'm not sure of what the number is, what the average size of the our Pleistocene hunter-gatherer progenitors was, where a lot of this stuff evolved during the Pleistocene. And the numbers vary, but it was pretty small. I mean, your average hunter-gatherer back in the Pleistocene probably only encountered 200 or 300 people at the most in his or her lifetime. But now we live in these massive societies that provide a lot of opportunities for mis-signaling, anonymity, right? Mismatch between what you really are and what you signal yourself to be. So doesn't that make it a little different? You know what I mean?
Of course. I mean, I think that reputation matters even more in this sort of information-dense societies, in which, you know, so hyper-connected society, in which so we're living in a sort of labyrinth of mirrors in which our image is projected and refracted in so many ways around us, and so we have to compose and recompose ourselves. In many ways, we don't have the strategies. That's why when I started to work at this project, I discovered how deep and how rich was the topic of reputation, because we are not such experts of dealing with it. So I think that the fact of crafting a social ego is, as you say, I mean, something that is deep entrenched in our human nature. So I don't think that it is something, it's only a sociological phenomenon that has to do with social media and hyper-connected societies, etc. I think that it's the masterpiece of our life,
yeah.
Who we are. And I think that the best moment in life is the moment in which we are recognized for what we wanted to be. We are seen as we wanted to be seen. It's very rare, but it's really a very powerful moment in life. I
mean, so
we are seen as we want to be seen. So we invest a lot of energy in this, and we are very clumsy sometimes.
Yeah, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about whether reputation matters with Gloria Rigi. We'd love to have you join this conversation. And Ken from Citrus Heights is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. With a name like that, you must have a good comment or question, Ken.
Yes. And I'm a friend of yours from Telos. You might remember that.
Ah. So what's your comment or question?
My comment is simply, what about the use of reputation as a form of social control? And in particular, the Chinese government is using its social credit system to track your traffic tickets and your credit scores and so forth, and then either gives rewards or puts penalties on you, depending on what that is. So I'd be interested to have your guest comment.
Thanks. Thanks for the question, Ken. That's a good question, Gloria. What do you think?
That is something. I mean, welcome to the age of reputation. You're totally right. I mean, the reputation, which we are talking in a very informal way, reputation has become a measure in many, many systems, especially, you know, I distinguish in my book between formal and informal reputation. Reputation has become formalized and it's measurable. Even for example, our behavior on a social network, we are not in China, but still, I mean, our behavior is on social network is measured, and it gives us a certain ranking. I mean, how reliable we are in certain kind of moves, etc. And this is a form of reputation. So, and of course, I mean, I think that it is becoming a deep thing in our societies. And this form, if we don't become a little bit more sophisticated in a way of dealing with these traces that we leave around, yes, there is a potential of control.
Yeah, but I'm really curious about this because, it seems like on the one side, we don't want a situation, you know, Big Brother is ranking you, right? And kind of there's a Black Mirror episode about that, which is And of course, as the caller was suggesting, you know, the in China, they're proposing introducing this social credit system. On the other side, there are surely some advantages for all of us from, you know, the fact that we give people medals for heroism and things like that, and you know, or even more informally, that it can become uncool to smoke, and suddenly you have, you know, it's something that Anthony Appiah, the philosopher, talks about,
these
sort of growing movements that actually affect positive social change on the basis of reputation. So how can we sort out these sort of good uses of norm setting through reputation from the bad ones?
But that's very interesting. But there is an interesting dynamics between social norms and how they change, and reputation. I mean, as Appiah rightly points out in his book, I mean, reputation can be a very honor. He talks about honor, but I mean, all these symbolic values, as are called, symbolic values, are related to each other. Of course, they are a strong incentive to change your norms. Basically, in many cases, they are the strongest incentive. I mean, I used to smoke when I was young in Paris. Everybody was smoking all the time. The dinners, I remember, were cigarettes everywhere. And now it would be really, it's not that I have any, of course, I mean, I know that it's bad, etc. But more than the moral judgment or my knowledge about what are the effects of smoking, the strongest force was really the changing of the social norm, that you're judged badly if you take out a cigarette now in a dinner. I mean,
That in California, Gloria.
I won't. Maybe with marijuana. Maybe you're cooler on other dimensions. I mean, norms change even sometimes in different ways.
So yeah, maybe, we've got another caller in the line. Mark from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Mark. What's your comment or question?
Thank you. My question is this. What if people, it seems to me like the discussion has assumed that you do something, people see what you do, they react to it in an accurate way. What if people completely misunderstand something that happens?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Completely misunderstands, and then they tell other people about it, and, you know, there it goes. What do you do?
That's a really good question, Mark. It's one of my questions, Gloria. I want to gang up with Mark on you. So, because people's perceptions of you and what you do, I mean, their perceptions are driven by all kinds of stuff rather than just the facts. So what do you do about that?
But I think that most of my book is about this question. I'm challenging a model. I've said before in this conversation that reputation is a signal, but actually I challenge this view that is a sort of a linear signal. I say reputation, it's not the opinion that other have. You send a signal in a linear way and then you receive back a certain judgment, etc. It's much more complex. It's a dynamic. It's a non-linear phenomenon, reputation, and that's why I just spent an entire book to try
right.
to understand
so
what it is.
Mark should read your book, but give him a little bit of a...
Yeah, I mean, it's a dynamic, exactly. It's a dynamic. It's not you adjust a lot. I mean, you start with a sort of, you try with some sort of signal. It doesn't work. It's blurred. People don't receive it. It is too refracted in order, and then you adjust your behavior. So it's in a sense, it is a much more organic phenomenon. You were talking about inauthenticity at the beginning. I mean, I really challenge in the book the distinction between authenticity and inauthenticity. We're trying to shape our life like little animals in a shell. I mean, and we construct our shell as we grow. I mean, and so the two levels, I mean, there is no, I mean, I'm against a sort of classical Goffman picture in which we have we are ourselves, and then we put a mask, and then we send a signal, and we see what the other people get it, and then they can be the signal can be misunderstood, etc. This is a very classical model that you have in signaling theory, I really challenge it. I mean, it's much more of a dynamic phenomenon, and we go back and forth, we adjust. So, in the case of the question that we have just received, I mean, I would say the extreme case in which people got everything wrong, well, you should ask yourself something about what are you doing. I mean, because it's really rare. I mean, it's much more of a process. It's not that.
Yeah, I hope we get to keep talking about this in the next section, because I think it's fascinating. There are cases, as the caller was suggesting, where you're misconstrued. There's the case where maybe you do one bad thing in your life, and
kick
a puppy.
Yeah,
and that's the thing that's attaching.
Yeah, but I mean, come on, if you kick a puppy, that it was something wrong.
I agree.
I know that was a joke.
And then there are cases.
Yeah, but I mean.
Then there are cases of people who won't name any names who get this reputation for being this, you know, a genius, you know, real estate developer, and, you know, it may or may not be earned, and that grants them high office. So it seems like there are some very complicated cases we should dig into.
So, yeah, I think we're going to have to save those for the next segment, because this is really deep stuff and I don't want to give it short shrift. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about reputation with Gloria Righi, author of Reputation, What It Is and Why It Matters.
What can we all do to make the reputation system a safer, more accurate and healthier environment? How can we make sure it provides useful information without destroying lives and livelihoods?
Reimagining the reputation system when Philosophy Talk continues.
After Black Friday and Cyber Monday, don't forget about Giving Tuesday.
That's your opportunity to give back to the community and to support organizations that make the world a better place.
Do we make the world a better place?
We definitely make the world a better place. We open eyes to different points of view. We bring philosophical thought to a broad public. We show people how to disagree without sending angry tweets.
So remember Philosophy Talk on Tuesday, November 27th.
And throughout the giving season.
All donations are tax deductible and directly support our production costs.
Help keep us on the air and online.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for your support. Open up, one star for this song. The
beats hella whack and the lyrics are wrong. Sucks. I mean, I thought it was decent. I mean, we both wrote this song. I don't know. Step back. I'm about to-
Are online rating sites like Yelp reliable ways to manage reputation? I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and our guest is Gloria Origi from the Institut Jean Nicot in Paris. And today we're thinking about reputation.
So, Gloria, I want to go back to a question raised by Josh toward the end and point you toward, I'm going to give you a role as a czar of the reputation system. Because you said it's a dynamic system. It's nonlinear. That means that the signal that I send may not be received by you to the other as what I intended. And we got to adjust. And you seem to suggest we're all in this together, kind of making mutual adjustments and all that. So I want to understand in your role as czar, how might we make this whole system function better? It obviously doesn't function perfectly. What's the one thing you would do to guarantee that cases like Donald Trump are weeded out from the system? He has his great reputation as a great businessman when he went bankrupt 6 times and blah, blah, blah. How would you adjust the system so that cases like that would be weeded out?
I mean, first rule would be to make my book a mandatory reading in every school of my empire. I mean, read my book everywhere. I mean, it's okay. The first thing. If in a primary school, you're obliged to read Reputation.
All right, what's the second thing?
This is very important because, what I'm trying to do, my book, I don't come up in the end with a big theory, a big model of reputation, but I give many examples how this works in very different fields and domains. Like, for example, how do we choose a doctor? How do we overestimate the reputation of an expert in finance and in economics, et cetera, et cetera? So I think I would like to have encompassing theory that explains, the rule in order to adjust for each domain how to adjust the reputation system. I have many, many, many good ideas in every domain we do stupid things. Like, for example, we all consider that we have the best doctor. A stupid thing that we all do. If you ask around and say, people say, oh yes, my doctor is the best one, which is impossible. Of course, it would be the best of the possible worlds, and everybody can afford the best doctor. So there are things that we should be aware, and also vulnerabilities and fragilities that we should be aware of when we are exposed to the evaluation of the reputation of other people.
But Gloria, let me ask you a question about the doctor example, just as one case. Here's the thing about doctors. They don't really rat each other out. That is, they have views about who's a great doctor and who's not. And a doctor once said to me about my other doctor, she's a great doctor, but they don't broadcast this. So, but how can we, as the consumer of healthcare, can we do this unilaterally? Can we somehow improve the reputation system for doctors to make it function to our benefit? Do you imagine?
I think that it is true. I mean, you're mentioning doctors and lawyers, for example. There are entire professions that are so relevant for our life, and their reputation is very mysterious. I mean, it's very difficult to understand how it is contracted. But the problem is that the way in which we rely on their reputation is completely, very, very, very often is completely stupid.
Yeah,
we
right.
don't even have the TripAdvisor of doctors. I mean, yeah. we just rely on our cousin's friend that is also the sister of, I don't know, of a neighbor.
So maybe the kind of I like your point about TripAdvisor. It may be that as things develop in this internet age, things are actually going to improve. You know, we'll be able to, higher number of users means lower standard deviation. It means a smaller margin of error, at least in theory.
Yeah.
So maybe things will actually get better on that count. But I wanted to push you a little bit, if that's okay, on the authenticity question. I mean, surely we wouldn't want to say that there's no difference between the apparent Donald Trump, for example, and the real Donald Trump in terms of, for example, his business
acumen.
I don't
see any difference.
So why not? What about you said, your doctor isn't necessarily the best doctor, but somebody might think my doctor's the best doctor. Doesn't that mean there's a difference between what we think about that person and what that person actually is?
I don't think, I don't think in the case of Donald Trump, really, I don't think that there is such a difference between who is, who
I mean, in terms, I mean, I mean, for the, in mean, terms of the people,
it's not
who
that
think
his reputation
a...
is so good. I mean, okay. in the eyes of many people. I mean, right. it's not that. I mean, it's just it's that there are many people that like guys.
Okay, but
like,
so let's leave Donald Trump aside. I mean, but surely, yeah. got, surely there are cases
I mean, I
where people
that
have
the,
undeserved
yeah, I mean,
reputation.
I think the you know it's a. This is a very deep philosophical theme, the inauthenticity, authenticity, opposition. I mean, the fact that sometimes, I mean, this is the big romantic theme, the big existentialist theme. Yeah. I live in Paris, Jean-Paul Sartre, the inauthenticity of life. And then, and actually, I challenge this paradigm. Really, I challenge it. I don't think...
Okay, but give us an argument.
Why should we? Ourselves, I do it because I don't think that there is a place, a day, or a moment in our life in which we are ourselves without our reputation around
so,
us.
Yeah,
if there is, there are moments in the day in which we are really without our social ego. I mean, I won't talk about these moments. I mean, but they are not interesting.
So, Gloria, it seems to me that you're saying, and Josh is disagreeing, you know, Josh is a theorist of French literature and philosophy, so he likes that existentialist authenticity thing. But it seems that you're saying, and Josh is disagreeing with you, I just want to see if I've got the two of you kind of right. I mean, you seem to believe that we're, in a certain sense, in terms of self-constitution, who and what we are, we're kind of all in this together, that I am partly constituted by how I am seen by others and how I see others seeing me, and this is a kind of huge dynamical system in which our identities kind of mutually emerge, and Josh's talks about authenticity seems to want to reject the kind of inherently kind of social kind of dynamical system by which we are constituted as who and what we are. I don't know if I've got the disagreement between the two of you.
Well,
right,
in my case, I'd want to say both. There's room for a bit of both, right? So there's a part of me that is in negotiation with the social, right? So I gave the example earlier of thinking you're funny. You can think, you know, one can think that one's really funny, but if nobody ever laughs at one's jokes, one's not really funny, right? So there is a part of who I actually am that is constituted to some extent by what other people think of me. But then there's also another part. And I can just lie about that, right? And if I'm really successful, then I can get people to believe something about me that just isn't true. And that's where I think there's room for the notion of authenticity.
So answer him shortly.
Yeah, but I mean, you can lie also to yourself all alone. I mean, it's not
inauthentic too.
It's not. I mean, the lie through it's another opposition. It's not the social, not social. I mean, you can lie to yourself and you're just giving justification of your actions that are not. I mean, actually, I think we lie to ourselves in order to keep a sort of good image to ourselves to our own eyes much even in the same way in which we lie to others. I mean, it's not that me others opposition that matters here. I mean, so the fact that you're philosophers. I mean, the fact that we are human beings and we are able to lie to ourselves.
Yeah, so I want to give one last caller chance in here really briefly. Ariana from San Francisco, welcome to Philosophy Talk. Can you be brief for us? Because we're getting near the bottom. What's your comment or question?
Yes. I appreciate you acknowledging the importance of the anxieties underlying people's control or image making and their reputation. But I do want to underscore the importance of the time that we're living in.
Yeah.
The Interglobal panel on climate change said that we have 12 years to turn around the human-made climate disruption that we are all facing. And we can look at the people who've really made changes, important changes in the past in our society, like Martin Luther King or Gandhi in India, and they were not considering the reputation as important factors when they made their decisions. And maybe they were ahead of their society radically, and people did not want to cooperate with them at the time. They condemned them, they assassinated them. But that's the kind of time we're living in. It gets us and invites us to rise above our fears about our own personal needs and reputation.
Thanks for the call, Ariana. Mm-hmm. So this is probably be our last point. But Ariana's saying a bold call for leadership that says reputation be darned. What do you think about that?
I think this is an important point. I would like to react to this because reputation doesn't mean conformism. I mean, I don't. I, I, I don't think that reputation means conformism. And you can also, for example, I think that Gandhi, I read a lot about him, and I think he was a, I mean, having a vision maybe is having, for example, investing your life to being understood, I don't know, later in a later moment. So conformism is just responding to the norms of your in your present. I mean, and you can just care about reputation and care about also the reputation, the honor of your people, etc. But maybe but having a vision also and thinking about, well, the norms will change and we will be the one who were right. And so, and this is, it's not that you're ignoring your social dimension. I don't think that Gandhi ignored not even a second his social.
Right.
His social
I think what she's picking up on.
He was just betting on another gaze on the world, and that is very important. That is important. I mean, not to be prisoner of the present, and that's something that leads us to be stupidly conformist.
Yeah, I got you. I think you and Ariana had a meeting of the minds at the end there. It's about taking the risk with your reputation, not caring about it, but being able to risk.
You can also bet on the reputation after. I mean, reputation is tricky. I mean, reputation survives your physical life. I mean, it's the immortal, as Shakespeare used to say, it's the immortal part of yourself. Reputation can change after your life. So for example, there are many artists that bet on their reputation in 100 years. Maybe in 100 years, I will be as famous as Taylor Swift.
Gloria, on that note, I'm going to thank you very much for joining us. It's been a reputation-enhancing conversation. Our guest has been Gloria Rigi. She's a senior researcher at the Institut Jean Nicole in Paris and author of the very fine book, which you should read, Reputation, What It Is and Why It Matters. So, Josh, you worried about your reputation?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm thinking maybe don't kick puppies.
Definitely don't. That was a joke.
Yes, totally. I have to say I'm more convinced than ever that we should care about a reputation. I mean, after all, I think Gloria's right. There is a part of me that is the way other people think of me, but it can't be the only thing you think about.
Well,
You have to have the courage. I agree with Ariane. You have to have the courage of your convictions. Just do what you think is right.
So on that note, I will say this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto, with apologies to Descartes, is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore, I blog. And you can become a partner in our community, and please do, by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog. Now, how fast can one person build a reputation for speed? We're about to find out. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, we know people by reputation, but that's a mixed blessing. Reputations come in good and bad, both of which are fueled by word of mouth or by a body of opinion from people whose reputation we trust. A reputation, in turn, assured by a trusted history from other people. It's a vicious cycle, and it's breaking down. People mess with their own reputations all the time. Donny Osmond does a Guns N' Roses song, so it'll seem edgy. Ozzy Osbourne signs up to do reality TV so people will see him as more than a guy who eats bats. He has a family, he has a house. Those who wish to do us harm often disguise themselves as reputable. War heroes have a reputation, but what good does it do them when they come home? Skill with weapons is often viewed with suspicion in an office workspace. You can become a movie star or a congressman, but options are limited. Way back when, we didn't need reputations. The king decreed something, his men would come by to make sure you did it. King didn't need a reputation, just dukes. If he was a bad king, other kings, a pope or a bastard princeling would take care of him. You know, history. That was your reputation right there. This order of things gave way to the collapse of empires and the rise of dictators' ideologies and flawed democracies. Freud, Darwin, and Marx worked their magic. Suddenly we were citizens. We had agency. We could be persuaded. Our desires became bullet points. We were citizens and customers, striding forward in our Silas mail order shoes into a brave new world. The makers of products or ideas did not have the skill set, as we now say, to get us to embrace Ford motor cars or the theory of relativity, so a whole new industry sprang up and a new job, the pitchman. The smooth baritone radio voice, and then the suave television presence. Eventually, women were thrown in there as well. People like this also presented the news. Walter Cronkite was a reputable epitome. Went downhill from there. We began to feel it was all just a big con, even if the pitch was true. And the shoe was a nice, sturdy shoe. We were only hearing about it because algorithms showed we were the kind of person who would buy that kind of shoe. And all the news began to feel like false flag propaganda, Vietnam, Iraq. We felt used. New persuasion strategies are launched all the time, or ways to work around it. Cryptocurrency is the latest workaround. It sells itself. It's a mystical interface between buyer and seller, no middleman, no banks. It's not only currency, it's an investment opportunity. Why hasn't it caught on everywhere? It doesn't have pitch, man, but swarms of engineers, tech nerds, economists, and obsessed libertarians keep yammering at us. This makes cryptocurrency seem disreputable, like a weird cult. And it's believers like con men trying to sell us a salted mine in Bolivia. Also, thanks to social media, we can now sell ourselves to ourselves based on what we bought before. Algorithms again. We're the con man and sucker in one package. Who needs a reputation? But that means we can't even trust ourselves. So advertisers are getting sneaky and desperate. I just read about the influence of influencers on promotion. Influencers are people who are kind of famous now, but in a new, hip internet kind of way. So some cute guy who's on a reality show who dated a Kardashian cousin or something gets a deal with a maker of high-end sunglasses to wear them on his fashion blog or his YouTube channel or taking Instagram selfies in Paris. He gets 50 grand for that. The shade maker gets, I don't know what, not a reputation. What does reputation even enter in? Fans just want to be the kind of person who can sport $700 sunglasses or who just wish they had $700. I think that's how it works. So I suspect the bottom is going to drop out of the social media stuff. I mean, there's nothing to keep us there, really. With reputation out the window, there's nothing to trust, just cheaper crooks and gaudier patter, and we will stop paying attention. How can we know it's true when we can't even trust the people telling us it's not true? We can't. Capitalism is going to grind to a halt any minute now. I'll stake my reputation on that. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2018.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Tina Pementorn.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
In order to restore calm, I'm invoking my authority as airport security to dock you one full ranking point as a punitive measure. This is a temporary measure.
No!
The score reverts to normal in 24 hours.
No, 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 but
during
I need it now.
Period, all downvotes are subject to a times two multiplier.
Times two?
We recommend you avoid negative feedback at this time.